Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Greetings and welcome to Under Consultation, the podcast going through the UK's greatest video game challenge TV show, Games Master, and the shows that came in its aftermath. I am one of your hosts, Luke Owen, and I'm flying solo today as, I'm flying solo at least for this intro portion, as I'm going to be sitting down with the co-creator of McNeil and Pamphilone Go 8-Bit, the very successful Edinburgh Fringe comedy show that spun off into its own London-based show. They got a bit of a residency. I mean, you're going to hear Steve talk about this in a second. And then became the TV show Dara O'Brien's Go 8-Bit. So I'm going to be chatting with Steve about that, about the genesis of the show, the successes of the original show, and how that translated to TV and the very, very difficult process that Steve went through getting that show made. And I'll be honest with you, when you finish this episode, you might think to yourself, it's amazing they got anything done. So without further ado, let's head on in to this chat. How are you doing today?
Yeah, I'm good, man. Thank you for having me on. I'm very excited to chat about it.
Well, it's been kind of nice for us, really, because we've gone through, you know, the sort of podcast journey we've been on. Like, you know, we started covering Games Master and then we finished that. And then we were like, well, let's look at all the shows that happened in between Games Master finishing and the reboot happening a couple of years back. So we looked at, you know, Thumb Bandits and Bits and... Ultimate Gamer on Sci-Fi.
Beautiful.
Gamesville.
Everything.
Pretty much Charlie Brooker's Games Wipe. Anything we could like basically find that was a free.
That's good, because now I know I can't be too niche in terms of reference points for your audience. That's great.
But we always felt like we were on this countdown to go 8-bit. And we did Video Game Nation as well. And I was like,
oh, wow. And you didn't get me on. How dare you?
That's because I'd spoken with Adam. And I've got questions about Video Game Nation for you coming up as well. So technically, I will have you on the Video Game Nation episode. But I was like, you know, when we get to it, we surely should reach out to Steve and see if he fancies a chat with us, because I'd really like to dive into sort of like how Go 8-Bit came together and everything like that. But before we get to that, because we were a Games Master podcast, I do have to ask you, what's your history with Games Master?
I'm 43 at the time of recording, which means I'm exactly the age of every Games Master viewer of notes. And yeah, it was watched religiously when I was a kid. I have very fond memories of it. I'm not going to say anything new about why Games Master was amazing, given you've done a podcast of every single episode of it. But to echo what is no doubt the overwhelming sentiment of what everybody has said about Games Master, as a sort of, you know, tween becoming teen adolescent in the UK in the 90s, it felt like a naughty thing that it wasn't meant to exist, but it did, and it was ours, and it was about the thing we loved, and it was truly special. I think Games Master uniquely occupies a place in British, if not global, TV history in terms of what it managed to do for gaming. Its importance cannot be overstated, which sounds like I'm blowing smoke up your ass because I'm on a Games Master podcast, but I'm not. It was a profoundly important show to me and millions of other people, and I have a lot of love and admiration for it as a thing.
So you'd have been
Frankie pretty... Ward ruined it, though. I mean, we should get that. I'm joking. I love Frankie. I know Frankie very well. She was brilliant in it, in the reboot.
I mean, you were of an impressionable age, I suppose, when the show came to an end. Were you watching any of the shows that came out afterwards? You know, the aforementioned Thumb Bandits bits, etc.
Yeah, a little bit. I grew up in Milton Keynes, so we had Sky TV on cable. So we had Sky for free. Because it was all very modern then, Milton Keynes. So pretty much every gaming show that turned up on Sky or one of its random offshoot channels over the years, I sort of fell away from it all probably about the age I discovered sort of alcohol and mischief. So sort of when I turned 16, 17, so sort of late 90s, I drift away from it. But anything up till then, I would have had a passing interest in. But obviously Big Boy Barry was my other big guy, who I'm very lucky to call a friend now as a result of my ridiculous career. But definitely watching his shows on Sky back in the day. That was probably the other main one for me. Because I think, what was it? Annoyingly, and I know you'll know the answer, because of course you will. What was the one that was on, like, Tea Time? On Sky.
So Games World.
Games World. Yeah, exactly that. So that was, I'd get in, eat a bowl of Golden Grahams dry, no milk, and watch a bit of Games World after school. So that was very much part of my routine when I was growing up. So that would be my other main. But obviously I'm familiar with and have seen pretty much everything else that they've ever, that anybody's, if you bothered to make a video game thing on telly, I've probably seen it.
Is the milk thing specifically for Golden Grahams, or is it just,
I like it in cereal like it's crisps. I always have. So I like a dry bowl of cereal that I eat like it's crisps, like sweet crisps. I don't know how weird that is, but I do it, and I'm too old to change now.
Well, I'm not one to kink shame, so are you?
It's not a kink.
On.
It's not a sex thing, which is weird because most things I do turn into sex things, but the cereal thing is just straight down the barrel food.
So let's talk about the incredible career that you've had, the bizarre career that you've had. What was
Let's go with bizarre, not incredible.
What was your comedy career pre Edinburgh Go 8-bit?
Really weird. So I got into performing quite late, I guess. I'd always been into it, so I did the school plays and all that sort of stuff. But I went and I did a management degree. I got a proper job when I left school. And then I hated it. And so I sort of got into amateur dramatics and things, little local community arts things. But I wanted to do it properly. I'd always quite enjoyed it. So I went to theatre school when I was 25, 26. I'd always lent towards comedy, so I tended to do better in like comedic roles and things. And then what happened was, a year after I graduated, I wanted to go to the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, because that's a thing, I think, if you're aspiring. And I went up there. I was in a musical about anti-terror legislation, which actually 5 stars in The Guardian, so actually it wasn't shit. Can I swear on this? I already have loads.
Yeah, you're fine.
Okay, all right, it's too late now, isn't it? The horse has bolted. But so I was in this musical, which was actually good. But I saw an advert on Chortle, the comedy website. They were looking for, at the time it was a black guy, an Asian woman and a white guy to be parts in this comedian's stand-up show. And it was all very cryptic. But I was the only white guy that replied, so I got in it. And what that turned out to be was Brendan Burns' show in 2007, which won the Perrier or whatever it was called at that point. So I sort of walked arse backwards into winning the biggest award in comedy by proxy to another man, and I had a small role. Occasionally, the clip goes viral of me and Sajila's role, who played my sister in it, because out of context, it looks like something it isn't. So yeah, once every couple of years, I'll get harassed by all my friends going, "Is that you?" Yeah, but it's not real. I enjoyed that, and as my background was in acting, this is a long answer, because my background was in acting, I didn't want to do stand-up, I wasn't brave enough to do stand-up at that point, but I thought sketch comedy would be all right, and Matt Holt, who was one of the directors of Brendan's show, he ended up helping me assemble a bunch of like-minded actors with a comedy leaning, and I got a little gang together. There was 15 of us initially, then there were six, and then when everybody had finally left, that left only me and Sam Pamphilon. So nobody else would work with us, but we stuck together and did sketch comedy for about 3 years. I was Rick Mayall's understudy in a Michael Frayn play, and his brain fell out his ears. So I had to be Rick Mayall instead of him. And that didn't run for as long as they intended it to as a result, but I was warmly received by the critics, but I don't have quite the, then or now, I don't have the draw of a Rick Mayall on the box office. So I was cursed to failure. But I was doing well as a comedy actor for a bunch of years, and then drifted into comedy.
You didn't have Nintendo calling you to be like, "We're going to redo the Nintendo adverts from the 90s that Rick Mayall did, but we're going to get you to do them instead."
I have never had Nintendo call me.
So you're working with Sam. I'm assuming this is where the origins of Go 8-Bit begin.
Nearly. We did three sketch shows. So we, 2010 to 2012, we did sketch comedy for 3 years. And then we'd got a sitcom in development hell at the BBC. And it came to sort of signing up for the Fringe again. And we hadn't written anything. We'd got I'm trying to remember now. We had a song that was rubbish, and a sketch about shades of white paint. And so we decided we wouldn't go to Edinburgh and spend 10 grand. Be a lot more now, wouldn't it? But 10 grand was obscene then. So we weren't going to go, but I was in a play, comedy play up there by Garrett Millerick, who's a brilliant stand-up who's doing really well at the moment. He'd written a play. So I went up and did that. And we'd originally, when we were going to go up to Edinburgh, do Go 8-Bit as just a fun thing at the weekends. And I said, I can't, there's no point if you're not coming. But Sam said he'd pop up and we'd do it anyway. So all Go 8-Bit was it was meant a bit, because the Fringe is horrible. We never had an easy run. We just thought if we could just get all our comedian friends leathered and play Mario Kart and swear at each other, that would probably be funny enough to charge people to watch. But even if it wasn't, if we'd been flyering all week and nobody had come to our sketch show, or we'd had a dreadful review, we could just get wasted and play video games. That's all it was. Like obviously, there's a Games Master podcast. The original, the first posters that we had, 2013, the sort of strap line was literally like Games Master in a cupboard drunk. Was like how we build Go 8-Bit. It's the original show. So the Games Master influence and brand was there from day one.
So I read online that it was kind of the Wii that was a bit of a sort of a turning point for you in terms of this, because it had a load of retro stuff on it. Is that kind of like it? How big was the Wii for you then?
The first Go 8-Bit show, so the 2013 one, the first year we did it, the live show was entirely run off a Nintendo Wii. And that was, I'm trying to think what games we played. It was because of the virtual console. So what it did was it was very lightweight, very portable. It had a good retro library without having to bugger around with emulation or anything. So I think, and it had multiple platforms. So I think we did, Mario Kart Double Dash, because Rohan was the other guy who directed Brendan Burns' show. He was the producer of Go 8-Bit at that point. He was a TV producer and he was helping us develop it. So we played Mario Kart Double Dash, Street Fighter 2, Turbo, the best one, and Bomberman, I think, was the other game that we had in the show. And then a guy called Guy Kelly would complete Sonic the Hedgehog 2 in under a minute, blindfolded, with his feet. Was the other thing that was in the show at that point. Because, yeah. But so, you could do Sega, Nintendo, newer stuff, older stuff. Bomberman's just a great one for four player, obviously. So it was just the easiest hardware in 2013 to run that off. And it got, did you do HDMI out? No, I think I went through a converter, but it was the Wii U that had HDMI out, wasn't it? But it do component, it upscaled to 480p or something. So it looked all right on a big screen.
Go on.
No. I think I've said more than enough about the connectivity sockets on a Wii. Please move the conversation to anything else.
We recently did a live show where we did some like video game challenges and stuff, you know, our own version of Games Master. And you made a right choice in doing everything just on a Wii. We ended up doing most of it on the Switch. But our final challenge we wanted to do was Saturn Bomberman, because you can do like the big 8-player, and it ended up being a nightmare to set up because we were trying to get a Saturn to run and two
doing
different
Go 8-bit live was horrible. Like the amount of work to make that show happen in 2013, it's not easy.
No, well, that's what I was going to ask. Like, you know, even if you're just running it through the Wii, are you still getting issues then with certain games, or is it with like people being a bit cack at them, or is it just a case of things going wrong?
Yeah, all that, and you know that, and that will no doubt continue when you have the conversations about the TV show. The way we picked games that weren't too hard to play. So like Street Fighter, you can just button mash. Bomberman, as long as you don't just stick a bomb on under your ass and stand there, you should be able to avoid it. And the later Mario Kart steer quite forgivingly. Like we were going to do the SNES Mario Kart, but it's horrible. It's impossible to let someone play, like get someone to play that if they've never played it before, because it's brutally sharp, the turns on it. But the logic of the games was that they were all quite straightforward, so they shouldn't be too bad. And whenever we could, we'd get the guests along with enough time to have a go on each of them, so they touched them. But the hardest bit about it, it's the hardest thing now when you see stuff done at gaming events and things. What people don't realise is how hard it is to make a live show that uses video games, because you've got to load games and bugger around with menus and get them ready. So the main thing that evolved with Go 8-Bit was we had a guy called Will Hartley, who was another comedian. He was Punishment Twat, was his official title in the live show. And so whichever team lost, me or Sam would have to do a horrible forfeit. But what Will would also do was he would set up the controllers. So while me and Sam were hosting and talking to the guests about the game we were going to play, Will was loading up the next game, going through the menus, getting them ready, so that by the time we finished talking nonsense, the game was ready to go. So there was never any waiting. It always kept playing. And that was the most important but also most difficult and labor-intensive thing, was learning and memorizing menu options and getting there quick so that the show could move on. So it was as much about that as it was anything else. It's making it actually happen.
Did you ever see the live episode of Games Master?
Yes.
Because that is, at times, painful to watch Dexter Fletcher like stall for time while they tried to get the next game set up.
Yes, I have and had seen that and was determined for... if you've ever tried to do a show at drunk people at midnight at the Fringe at the weekend, they would not have tolerated that level of bluster. We needed to bulldoze through it. And if somebody wasn't downing a pint of jalapeno brine, then they better be playing a video game. It would kick off. So there wasn't the luxury of breathing space in the live version of Go 8-Bit.
But did it do well? I suppose that's the key to it. Is like, was the show successful? Was the reception to it good?
It was amazing. It's the only time me and some of them have read anything approaching buzz. It was very cool because it wasn't billed. We didn't really talk about it, and it sold out. We added an extra show. Immediately got a residency in London. Immediately, like within like a month of Edinburgh, I think Roe had picked it up for development for telly. Uncommonly successful. It's no coincidence that it was Dave who picked it up, obviously ran with Taskmaster just before, sort of looking for those late night gang show things up at the Fringe Festival. And Go 8-Bit just clicked. It was incredibly successful. And I do miss those live. I don't miss the work, but the live Go 8-Bit in its original incarnation was quite a sight to behold.
Do you have any like lasting memories of that original show, or the original shows that you did?
Yeah, I think particularly the real original ones, where it was myself and Sam with the team captains. We would get other sketch acts to come. So in the original one, like Jenny Bede, who's a brilliant comedy actress, she had like a video on YouTube doing like a version of Lana Del Rey's video games as Princess Peach. She came on and performed that live in between the games. Beast has got a great sketch about Mr. Needle Mouse as the original Sonic the Hedgehog name. So we had like a sketch called the Real MacGuffins, were another one. They wrote a sketch that was all puns on game titles. And so it was much more because our background was sketch stuff, it was it there was a lot of narrative and stuff to it. So it was very, very rich. There was songs, there was sketches, there was gameplay battles. We had Paul Foxcroft and Richard Soames, who were brilliant improvisers. They were commentating on the live thing. We had Will as the punishment twat. So you've got the forfeits. Guy Kelly, who did these insane challenges with like blindfold with his feet and all that stuff. It was like a whole, like the, especially when we did the first year, like the, I think the first Edinburgh venue, it was like a 50 seater. And there's maybe 20 people on stage because we've got guests as well. So you'd have me, Sam, Will, Guy, Paul and Rich with the cast. You'd have two guests for round one, two for the second round and four for Bomberman for round three. So like, there was almost more people in it than there were in the audience. And it was, and it came, it just came at you so hard and fast for now. It was a glorious, glorious thing. And, you know, by the end of it, you know, we've been given dead arms, eaten jalapenos, drunk a tuna smoothie, and you know, the whole room stinks of blended fish. It was, it was a wonderful thing. I mean, it was a ridiculous shambles, and it needed polishing for telly. But it was. It's probably the best thing any of us will ever do. Those live shows were phenomenal.
So you said you and Sam were working on sitcoms for the BBC. They're stuck in development hell. Were like, yeah. Did you sort of just abandon those and just sort of outright, or were they essentially they all just fell apart? And you were like, well, maybe let's just try this instead then.
Well, the main one we'd got a sketch. It was actually the first thing Sam ever brought to me as a sketch that he'd written, which was about a city trader, this obnoxious city trader, and it was in it was a sketch pilot called For the Win, and it was in that, and it really took off, and the video of it went viral. So then they wanted us to work up a sitcom for it, and sort of, but. As there's a million people will tell you the same story with the BBC. By the time you've actually got it into some sort of shape that's half decent, the person who commissioned it's gone, and the new person doesn't care, or they've got opinions that completely strip the essence of what the thing was anyway. So eventually, it just becomes this horrible Frankenstein's monster dog's mess of an idea that either gets made, and then you know the writers and talent get screamed off the internet. While the producers go on and continue their careers bulletproof, or it just doesn't get made. And I can't remember what it was called now. But whatever that sitcom was called, it was very funny. But it was not to be. But by that point, it didn't matter because GoAbit was in development, so we were moving on to that anyway.
So was that developing through, was it like literally UK TV Dave would approach me? Because when I spoke with Simon Longdon about this, and he said that it might have been something that Jinx were, you know, at least pitching towards Jinx. Or was it several different sort of people you were courting?
Yeah, so the Jinx thing, the guys at Jinx actually came along to the very first GoAbit. So it was at the Canal Cafe in London, like the first preview we ever did. And it was because I'd started talking, I'm always hustling. And because I'd started making a video gaming comedy show, I'm immediately thinking about, right, what can we do with this? And so I reached out to Jinx, which I imagine your listeners do know, but it's a video gaming TV channel in the UK and internationally. And I just reached out to them and said, like, we're working on this thing. You might be interested. So they came along to the first one. And I ended up, through that relationship with Jinx, that's how I met Simon and Mason, who you talked to, and a guy called James Neal, who was a brilliant man who, unfortunately... didn't exist in an environment where he could make Jinx the thing that it always should be, but never quite is. But so I started writing reviews, and I started writing scripts for Dan and Co on, and actually for what's his name, Tom Deacon, the original video game Nation host, and I've forgotten the woman's name. She died sadly. She
passed away a couple of years ago. Yeah.
Yeah. Horrible accident. So I started writing for Jinx, and they were looking at maybe make a great bit, but budget and just Jinx's inertia generally made that quite difficult. But so I ended up, because GoAbit didn't get filmed until 2016, but I gave up my day job started 2014 because I was working full time for Jinx, sort of writing and making like review videos and content for them. So I worked for Jinx for 2 years, pretty much full time.
Which is probably where you were on the first version of Video Game Nation, the original version of the show.
We were on episode one.
Yeah.
Go 8-bit itself, the live version of Go 8-bit is on the first
episode. That's right,
yeah. Yeah.
Which has been completely lost to time, because from what I've been told, Jinx just deleted everything. So like it just does not exist anymore.
Just arguably the best gaming magazine show of the last 20 years, but yeah, just accidentally deleted it.
Just that original version, Simon would describe as the Simon years of the show before Adam Mason took over and made it better.
Shout out to Simon. Simon, it's not Simon's fault. Like, so we got Simon to work on Go 8-Bit. Simon was good, but Mason's version. Mason was allowed to make a better show. Simon struggled against
it, I think. The way that Simon explained it to me was that it was a show that, I mean, he described me, he wanted to do a review of BioShock, but from the perspective of a horse.
That sounds like Simon's version of the show.
It went down like a lead balloon. But while it was all sort of falling apart around him, he was chatting with you about the development of the So when you're developing the live version for a TV, what sort of changes were you looking to make?
Well, we weren't looking to make any changes to it, but that's telly. we liked our show, and we'd have loved to have pointed cameras at it and put it on the telly, but. How would all the people in telly justify their salaries if they didn't change it and ruin it, Luke? I'd have been more than happy to put the original thing on the telly. We knew it was good because without any of them interfering, it sold out and people liked it. But that's not how telly works, Luke. Edinburgh, the first year, we did three previews and that was just working out how to do it. And then we did five nights in Edinburgh. And then after that, we had a monthly residency at the Wenlock in Essex, which is just shut, actually. It was in Islington. And we did a monthly show there. And what we started doing was we would do a new show each time. So me and Sam would write a new song to open the show. We'd book different guests to play the games. We'd play different games. We'd always write a new video gaming sketch that we would do. And we'd book guests that also performed gaming material. I think it had an interval, so it was probably an hour and a half, 2 hour show that was new every month, which was a lot to turn over, but there were a lot of people in it. But then as Roe, who by that point had given us an appallingly small amount of money to try to get it on the telly, we started to repeat things month to month, because what we were trying to do was refine what we'd got and make it better in the hopes that the TV people who said they'd turn up would actually turn up and see it. And then make it. So it started to become more repetitive, which I think was the right thing to do in terms of Roe getting it commissioned, which was his job. The difficult thing was Go 8-Bit as a live show had all this buzz around it and had a very loyal audience. You know, it sold out very quickly when we put it on sale. And when that repetition came in, then some of the audience would quite reasonably sort of drift away from it because they've seen that. That tension between doing a live thing for its own sake and getting something made by telly, that was sort of the first tensions of that, because we just wanted to make continue to build that successful thing that we built.
Just lastly, before we kind of move into the development with the TV shows and stuff.
Yeah.
Who Go 8-Bit? Was it you or Sam that came up with that?
The name's Sam. Actually, the name is Sam's contribution to the Go 8-Bit story. which is an appallingly low rent pun on Go Ape Shit. You're going to talk about this. So when it was a live show, McNeil and Pamphilon go ape shit, right? Mm-hmm. That's a shit pun, but that does make sense. Dara O'Brien's go ape shit doesn't mean anything, does it? And that, if you want an understanding of telly in a nutshell, that. It's only an apostrophe. That's the only difference, really. Apostrophe. But it makes a thing that worked not work. Just one little flick of the pen and it's all buggered. And that's not relevant to the story.
It's probably why I didn't pick up on the pun until watching the show.
It's like, let's go.
And even let's go 8-Bit. I was like, oh, let's go 8-Bit. I get it. Yeah, I see.
Oh. Yeah. Oh, the other person we haven't mentioned before we move on, Rob Sedgbeer, the gorgeous Rob Sedgbeer, who is now my other half on Wi-Fi Wars, the new thing I do. He approached us at the live show with this technology you got where the audience can all play games on their phones. And so from very early on in the residency, we had these lock-ins where we would do interactive stuff where the whole audience would play on these things that Rob had created. So Wi-Fi Wars became its own thing. But part of the buzz of the live show was we got this cool thing that nobody else could do, which was the whole audience played games and things on their phones. So I must mention him because I'll see him tomorrow and he'll tell me off.
So what were the development meetings like when she was chatting with UK TV and Dave?
Well, Dave came in quite late. So for a long time, for about a year, we were just trying to get any bugger to watch it. And they kept saying they'd come and never do. It's quite hard to get execs to leave their offices and watch things. And I mean, in truth, the process was, it was quite tense between me and Ro. Me and Ro, Ro had directed Brendan's show in 2007, and he'd also co-directed with Matt, who directed Brendan's show, me and Sam's 2012 sketch show, Olympic Other Production. And me and Ro had been friends for a very long time, but in a very, I love Ro like a brother, which means I hate him like a brother. And I think that's mutual. We're still very good friends now. Like, we play D&D together and we love each other very much. But at that particular point in our careers and ego development, there wasn't a lot of room between our two opinions for warmth. So we were at loggerheads, and it was quite tense. But in truth, as we found out when it got commissioned, we didn't know how good we got it with Ro. I should have appreciated him more at the time, but it was quite difficult because me and Sam were just trying to make a career, and we got this live thing that was going well, and we were repeatedly tailoring the show for executives who didn't turn up at the expense of pleasing and growing our audience for the thing that already existed. So it was a conflict of interest, but a necessary one, but it made it quite difficult. And I think Sam was less video gamesy, but also Sam has a less confrontational way of navigating things and can be more passive. Not as a criticism, but he'll I at that time wasn't very good at just letting things go, so I didn't. I can be quite hard work. My people close to me would say I'm still hard work, but I'm not as bad as it was at that point. I would be the first to put my hands up and say I had strong opinions and I voiced them regularly.
What were those opinions then? If you don't want to say, you don't have to say, but
honestly, I don't even know, but I know I'll have had them and I know they'll have mattered then. But that's sort of the point, isn't it? About what I am is I'll have had a very strong opinion about a thing then. And for good reason, as far as I was concerned, what that was is lost in the mist of time. And I imagine nobody else can remember either, because grand scheme of things, who cares? But when you're trying to work on, you know, the third beat of the comedy sketch in this month's Go 8-Bit live show to 130 people, that's all that matters then. But it doesn't now, so it's fallen. I'm terrible at remembering things anyway, but so it's fallen out of my brain. But yeah, no, I don't know. But I know that me and Ro had to take ourselves aside at one point and just go, can we stop being horrible to each other, please? Because we love each other and this is horrible.
Our two teams will be battling out over five different video games from gaming history.
It's game on.
Play.
Can't see her.
She's behind you, hitting you in the head with a lightsaber.
But this isn't all about high scores. That's mostly about high scores. Dan O'Brien's Go 8-Bit starts Monday the 5th of September, only on Dave.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank.
LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Okay, so what was development like then? Did they literally say, here's what we want to change, and you were like, well, we'd rather not change this, we think we should do this instead?
Yeah. But they won. So we filmed a pilot in... when did we film the pilot? In the middle of 2014, I think, at the Tabernacle, which is where Acast filmed all his stand-up specials. And various other, I think, I'm trying to think, somebody else's show had been filmed in there, a Dave show, so it was already rigged with lights and things. But at that point, what happened with Go 8-Bit was, I think what TV would have liked to have happened is that we'd all fucked off and they just made it with other people. But somehow me and Sam ended up in it, not in every edit, but in some episodes, me and Sam are in it. But everybody else who'd been involved in the live show slowly got shit canned. So the first people we lost were Paul and Richard, who were the commentators. And that became me and Sam doing commentary. And at the point we filmed that first pilot, though, Will, who was the punishment twat, was still in the show, and we filmed it before a live audience. We filmed it in a theater in front of a live audience, and the forfeits were still very much a big part of it. The forfeits, even at the point the TV show got commissioned, Will was in the final run through December 2015 in that role. So Will and forfeits were part of the show until the point of commission. Me and Will are still friends too. He also plays D&D with me and Ro. Everybody I've ever ruined careers, I've kept them as D&D characters instead. It was quite unpleasant. It was very unpleasant. I had a breakdown. It was miserable. I nearly walked off the show, between series two and three. It was made very clear to us, to me and Sam, that we were very lucky that we still might be in our show, which I don't care for as a position. Because I think if that's your position, you're a cunt. And I stand by that. So it was very, very tense. And through that process, as Telly wanted to do a telly all over it, that left me and Sam, and maybe me a bit more, because I was more actively developing it. Sam was working on another show down in Bristol a lot of the time. I'd got all my mates to be involved in a show for fun in Edinburgh, and now I was slowly having to really, really tell my mates, great news, the show might get on telly and you're not in it. Doing that repeatedly to all the people who put all the effort in to make the thing good that TV had then paid to fuck to death, weren't going to get to benefit from it. So everything about making Go 8-Bit for telly was really unpleasant and miserable. I've had a lot of therapy and I'm doing a lot better now, so I can say that in good faith. Did I enjoy anything about it? No. Not really. I'm proud of it. It could have been a lot better than it was, but I am proud of it, and I know a lot of people love it. I don't want to be completely down on it, because if you haven't had to live through the politics of it and just accept it at face value as the final thing that it was, it's a perfectly serviceable show where funny people play games, or people from soap operas in series three for some reason. But generally it's a solid show, but it could have been a lot more. And the way in which What it taught me was, it's why I do Wi-Fi Wars now, I just do a live show, me and Rob are the bosses and we do whatever we want, is the nature of taking something from a fun thing done with passion by a group of people and allowing that to exist in a sort of corporate model. The compromises you have to make aren't ones that I'm comfortable with. And I didn't know that at the time. And unfortunately, I discovered that in the process. And it left a bitter taste. But what we wanted the show to be was almost always at odds with what the TV channel needed. And it's not that they're wrong. They weren't trying to make a good show. It's just it wasn't the show that we were trying to make.
Yeah,
and that can only lead to conflict or resentment or people being at loggerheads, because at what point do the creative energies behind the show not get to say what the show is creatively?
I suppose one of those big changes coming in is Dara, and it, you know, obviously we joked about the title a moment ago, but Dara coming in, he's the host of the show. It is now Dara O'Brien's Go 8-Bit.
Indeed.
But was he at least pleasant to work with?
No, Dara was great. And again, Ellie, who we got in fairly early on, she'd hosted the Go 8-Bit stage at EGX with us. She'd sort of done game interviews, and she was a very big advocate of the show, and she knew her onions. So we really wanted Ellie on board, and we were delighted that she sort of got cast and was in that. She was definitely, you know, we were really, really keen to use her. And Dara is a legitimate gamer who, in every interview he gave, he was always very, he always made the point of going, you know, Steve and Sam's show, and then I'm hosting it, but they developed it and they did this thing. He was very generous and kind in the way he made sure we got recognition. The way it was explained to us that it was Dara Brin's Great Bit is that on the EPG, on the electronic program guide, people are sort of skipping through it. If they see the name Dara O'Brien, they'll watch that. So even just calling it Go 8-Bit, that doesn't mean anything to anybody, but Dara's name has some weight. So that's why it wouldn't be Go 8-Bit with Dara O'Brien. It's Dara O'Brien's Go 8-Bit, because then you see Dara's name and you click on it. So there is a telly. That might be bullshit in the way that everyone in telly thinks they know things and they don't. So at some point it has become received wisdom with TV execs that's true. I will confidently bet you everything in my bank account, no proper scientific study of whether that's horseshit or not has ever been conducted, but they've all decided that's true. Thus it has become true. And for fear of losing their jobs by making a brave choice, everyone just goes along with that. And so that is why that is that. And that's a lot of the case with telly. It's not bad people making deliberately divisive choices. It's people with careers who are trying to not waste £1 million, trying to go with the best guess at what's probably a good idea. But that is a far more conservative way of creating something than let's just get leathered at midnight in Edinburgh and see what comes out of that.
Yeah.
They're very different approaches to making a thing. So I'm not down on UK TV, who were the only channel who took a punt on it, or even the production company, who again were the only production company, DLT, who were willing to give it a look in. I might have disagreements of opinion over the ways they conducted themselves or the choices they made or the way they managed the relationship with the creative core that grew the show, but they weren't trying to fail. Because no one is. Everybody believes they're right. But as the viewing figures show, they weren't.
So, like, we, you know, we made the joke about the name earlier. Were you just sort of told, this is what we're going to do? But did you point out, well, the apostrophe doesn't make sense now?
Oh, yeah. Don't matter. Doesn't it? Doesn't it matter what words mean? All right. I don't know how well that this bodes for the comedy we're writing, but yeah, all right. Yeah, no,
I'm sure it was. Righto. You took that advice on when you wrote your book. The words don't matter.
Oh, any old shit. just remember, after about 8 lines, that's a paragraph, and then you start a new one. That's it. That's how words work. Yeah, no. It doesn't matter.
when I spoke with Simon about this, because he was telling about the original version of Video Game Nation and then going on to this, he said that there was kind of like a difference of opinion between there were people, the telly people and the gamer people, and sort of like a series producer was sort of like leaning more towards the telly people than the gaming people. Like the way that Simon said it was like the series producer didn't like video games, so he just sort of just wanted to do this instead.
Well, I did a stand-up show which in part sort of covered the genesis of this, and in that I talk about the first thing that I won't name them because that doesn't seem fair, but the first thing that person that Simon's referring to ever said to me when I met them, because they've been brought on board to series produce Go 8-Bit, was, I don't really like comedians or video games. And at that point, Luke, I had a feeling things might not be as straightforward as I'd like. Because our pitch for Go 8-Bit was comedians play video games. There's only one word in that three-word sentence that he actively didn't dislike. So 66% of the words in that are things he doesn't like. And the middle one's play.
Because Simon also said that you had like almost a small pool of games to choose from as well. And it's like when you're sort of putting together the challenges, like how difficult is that, you know, dealing with the companies and stuff? Because like in series two, like I only brought this one out, as James wants to play Street Fighter 2, but you're playing Street Fighter 5. And it's a case of just Capcom just wanting you to play the new game rather than the old one.
Sometimes there were several things. I have to be a bit careful how I phrase this one, but I can answer it. When we did the live show, I just played the games I wanted to play. So very similar to if you're on Twitch, just go, bugger it, I'll play that. And you do. And no one cares. We all accept that basically, if you made Street Fighter, you're delighted that an influencer with viewers is playing it, because then people go, oh, I'll buy Street Fighter. That it basically works as a model. We all just go, yes, all right. and that's fine. If you are the lawyer for a TV production company, you cannot sign off on that as a system, which means you have to get permission to use other people's IP. That is correct and necessary to meet the requirements of being a broadcaster. That being said, there is a sliding scale of the level of reassurance and usage you need to secure. And what happened in the earlier days with Go 8-Bit was, and I must add this disclaimer for my own sake, I don't know that it was exactly this, but something to the effect of, we were looking to be able to, the wording was of the form of using the likeness of those video games in our show globally in perpetuity. So the reason for that was the production company wanted to be able to sell the show internationally. So you don't want to get in a situation where you go, oh, we can't give them episode 3, because actually we were only allowed 5 years of Frogger in the UK or Europe. So I can't. So it becomes a mess. So you just need to be able to go, if I make this TV show, that's my product. So I want to be able to sell that product forever to everyone. That makes sense. Unfortunately, with the way video gaming clearances work, it's why Nintendo weren't in the show till Series 3 part of this. If I go to Nintendo UK and go, can I play Mario Kart on Dave next week? They'll go, yeah. If I go, can I film me playing Mario Kart and sell that to TV stations all over the planet forever, please? They'll go, we should check with Japan. I don't know if you know anything about Nintendo in Japan, but they're busy. So it isn't a priority for the lawyer of Nintendo Japan to reply to our emails about playing Captain Toad Treasure Tracker on a cable channel in a small island. So you just hit an impasse. Now, the way this, we're really getting into the weeds on this, but I guess it's of interest to the people. If you're one of the many listeners listening to this going, oh, Steve's not as shit as I thought he was, and actually I can see why I hated Go 8-Bit, welcome. these are the problems that made the show not the thing that neither I nor your listeners wanted it to be. But what UK TV, the company that owns the Dave TV channel, needed was the ability to show those games on UK TV and on their online platform for, say, 2 or 3 years. So what we needed was 3 years UK, which somebody in a UK office for a lot of games companies, I've referenced Nintendo, I'm just using them illustratively, but any games company in the UK could probably gone, yeah, fine, we'll sign it off now. Because the production company wanted to be able to monetize the product they were making internationally, and because they wanted a level of reassurance that they'd got their asses covered, by asking for something more onerous than we needed for the UK one, we ended up with nothing. So that made it harder to even make the thing just for the UK. So for the games clearances as a thing, what we could and couldn't use, that became far more of a thing than it needed to be for that UK show. But as ever, it wasn't people trying to deliberately ruin my lovely baby. there was a valid business case and a point of view that made that necessary for certain parties. Unfortunately, if too many people involved in trying to make a thing like Go 8-Bit all just hold their position, it's very hard to do anything, because it's quite a complicated set of moving parts to make a show like that exist. So that's a very long answer, but accepting the fact that I now add the disclaimer, legally that might be horse shit and I'm not blaming anyone, that is the essence of why it was so difficult to get games clearances on Go 8-Bit.
I promise you, like, I don't want all of my questions to feel like, and why was this bad, or and why was this difficult? But from what I've been told,
it was making Go 8-Bit was really bad and difficult. There's a nice thing exists now. I don't want to be down on it. Loads of people love that show. Over 1 million people watched it each week when it was at its peak, and a lot more have watched it since online. It was a very successful gaming show, and people love it. I've had a lot of people come up to me at live shows saying, you know, it sort of got us through lockdown. We would just binge watch that, and we had a lovely time. It's what got me and my kids to start talking about video games. I've been told 1 million lovely stories that make me very proud that we made it. As we're here talking about making video gaming TV, I owe you nothing but honesty. And it wasn't easy or fun making Go 8-Bit.
And I believe one of the real tricky things was tech issues. So, yeah. So the way it was described to me is because you're playing it off the big screen, there was lag. Mm. And that meant that people were having their inputs and stuff. Yeah. And they weren't, the inputs they were doing weren't really matching up with, you know, there's a couple of seconds behind on what they're doing there.
No, and it really, maybe more than anything, that contributed to the murder of Go 8-Bit's longevity, because I think when the first series came out, it was only 6 episodes, it was new. We'd never, telly had never thrown that much money at gaming, really. It was really expensive, Go 8-Bit. You know, we've got a rotating stage, the massive wall. You know, booking proper, like Bob Mortimer, like proper talent costs money as well to book guests like that on the show. It was very, very expensive. And so I think we, the gamers, were by and large delighted and shocked to see that telly had actually made a thing with production values of more than £6 about video games. So there was a lot of goodwill around that. And because it was new and exciting and they pushed it and it was shiny and it was different, it was successful. And what that meant, as Dave often do, they very quickly, if a thing's gone well, they want to make loads more of it. So they immediately commissioned series 2 and 3 and made them 10 episodes each. We were going to make another 20 straight off the back of those 6 and the spin-off show, which is better, Go 8-Bit DLC, which we made 10 episodes of. So in the space of 4 months, we filmed 30 episodes of telly in 2017. It was relentless. But there was, through that, there was a dilution of what it was. So the goodwill existed in series 1, and the goodwill actually sustained on DLC, because that was clearly people who knew about games, who cared about games, getting into it and talking about games and having fun, not worrying about it being an in-joke or a thing you needed. Go 8-Bit always, because it was treading that line of light entertainment, needed to not make non-gamers not watch it, or it felt it did. I don't think it did. I think there's enough people who play video games for you not to care. But telly had an anxiety about alienating non-gamers, so Go 8-Bit had to spoon-feed you. It was, what is Tetris? Everyone knows what Tetris is, and if they don't, they're not watching this. So you don't need to explain, just play fucking Tetris. But Go 8-Bit, I understand why the main show needed to and the other one didn't. But because of lag and us becoming more part of the furniture, series 2 of Go 8-Bit was where the gamers on social media started to lay into the show a little bit. And one of the main criticisms it got was, why the fuck are they booking people who don't know or like game? None of these pricks that are coming on can play games. So what's, I don't want to watch people not know how to fucking play video. They should be playing it and playing it well. But they were all good at playing games. And when we were in the green room, which we had set up with consoles, with all the games, we'd get them into ours before and get them to play the games. Me and Sam would go and sit in with them, have a chat, make sure they knew all the buttons, all the controls, if they hadn't played them before. We'd let them know in advance what the games were so they could prep them at home if they wanted. But there was, if you've seen Go 8-Bit, where the compute, where we all sat, the sofa, that was on the edge of this massive revolving stage. And from the consoles, which were by our feet, because we needed the connectivity of the controllers, so the controllers were near the consoles. You then had a wire that ran all the way to the middle of the revolving stage, because it had to, because of the way it was built, because it rotated, dropped down, then ran all the way across the studio floor, massive TV studio floor, up the wall, into a gallery that's about 40 foot high, into that desk, then send a vision feed back from there, back to the studio floor, into the LED screen. And by the time you sent a video, no matter what, and we'd got all the toys, no matter what you're doing, by the time the videos got to that screen, there's lag, and quite a lot. Now, in some of the games, it could be half a second to a second of lag, which to a non-gamer won't sound like much, but I challenge anyone who thinks they're good at timing the jumps in Super Mario Brothers to do it if I give you a second of lag. I actually got quite good at it because I used to practice on the studio floor in the rehearsals and get a feel for it. And I can play games preempting turns and things in racing games because I had to, because I was meant to be a gamer and I didn't want to be humiliated being rubbish as the gamer on the gaming show. But the guests quite rightly got, you know, Susan Cameron was just doing donuts in a tunnel on Ridge Racer. Like, she can smash that course on Ridge Racer. She can't smash it if when she turns right, it doesn't turn right. So she presses it again and then it turns right. So it's impossible. And the reason given initially was cost, that it would be too expensive to have monitors on the desks. And actually, when I offered to literally pay out of my own money to put monitors on the set, genuinely, so I'll pay for them. I will pay for monitors on set. What it became apparent was that they wanted these low camera angles of our faces, and they didn't like the idea our eyelines would be downwards at monitors because visually it would look bad on TV. The problem with that is, yes, it might look slightly worse if our eyelines aren't as visually appealing to traditional telly, but if everybody on the show where you compete on video games can't play the video games, it doesn't matter how nice our faces look. The gaming is a waste of everyone's time, and that's what the show is. It's competing on games. So, again, it's that telly versus gamers thing, and it was a big point of contention between us. You've got all the gamers going, you've got to have monitors with zero lag, or you can't do the thing. And production, again, naming their names, going, I'm not having shit cluttering up the desk and getting in the way of the shots. That ruins the thing. What should have happened was that the set and the camera shots were made sensitively around monitors, which were as much as possible made invisible or minimal in terms of impact on screen. That should have been the solution because it's the only way you can do it. When we did, even in the first Go 8-Bit on stage, we'd have a telly on the floor in front of them, which was a live feed, and we'd then take a feed from that to the projector screen behind them. So the guests used to face front, so you could see their faces. So you'd watch them screaming, and you could see the game going on behind them, is always how we did it live. Because as with so much of it, we'd solved it live. We already knew how you had to do it, because we'd had to make it work in front of a live audience. But, yeah, so that was the issue, the lag thing. It was huge, and for me, it wasn't respecting games as being the heart of it or trusting in the games being the entertainment themselves. And it was then this tendency, as they'd lent into light entertainment, to book not comedians. You know, it was comedians play video games is what it was, because if you make a comedian play a video game, whether they're good or bad, they're funny. And that's entertaining. If you get somebody on who's like Simon Gregson was a very nice man, but he's been a soap actor for 30 years and he's not predisposed to be spontaneously funny about video games when he's also trying to play them, because a lot of people shut down. And so by booking not funny people to be guests on that show, that also had an impact on how entertaining it was. But the lag was brutal because it came. Oh, the third thing It's all coming back. They originally, the way the show worked to balance when me and Sam did it live and for the TV show was I'm a gamer, so I get the non-gamer guest. Sam's a non-gamer, so he gets a gamer guest. By series three, they were putting the gamers with me for some reason because they thought the balance of whatever the talent was looked better or whatever on screen on the sofa together. And Sam ended up with a lot of the non-gamers. So the episode I remember the most was I had Nish Kumar on my team, and I think Sam had Anna, I want to say Richardson. She's not a comedian on his team. She'd never played some of the games in her life and had no idea. And it even made the edit. There was a point where Dara sort of said, oh, so how are you feeling? Do you think you're going to win? And I said, it'd be weird if we didn't at this point. Because it's like, well, you've got two gamers here who've played it, and you've got two dickheads over there who've got no idea what you're talking about, who don't know the way around the controller. So, yeah, I think we'll win again. Yeah, you know who's going to win this race—the guy with no legs, or which again is about thinking about the visual, making a light entertainment telly show, and going, yeah, but hang on, they're all actually doing something, and that's games. So it was the lack of respect or mindfulness paid to the gaming is I think what killed the show. I think if we'd have stuck to our guns and only booked comedians. Balance the teams between me and Sam as they should have been, and solve that issue that made the gameplay actually legitimately exciting and good and close. I think it would have run like Taskmaster has, but there were enough things done wrong that it just sort of drifted away. Less people came back to it because either the guests weren't funny or the gameplay just wasn't good enough to enjoy watching. I think it was too one-sided.
We've already recorded like our review of the first episode of it. Like that's the episode we looked at, which is David.
That's a good one.
It is good because I mean I really enjoyed the fight between you and David James on Tekken.
Yes.
And yeah. I thought like David James is a really interesting guest to book on this because usually it's comedians. You know, I'd have thought
it was actually good because our only exception was that if they're proper gamers, it's all right. Yeah. And David That's James it. Is a proper game. Jodie Kidd as well. We had Jodie Kidd. She was pretty because she like builds PCs for fun.
That's it. Yeah. Kidd's
proper games. Like, that's all right because then at least they can talk with knowledge.
Well, plus as well, David James has got the history because he once gave us an excuse for being bad at a football game.
Exactly.
I was up all night playing Tekken. So like it's got a perfect in to be a guest on the show.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly that. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's true. That is important. That was all right. But the one, Gregson and Richardson and some of the other ones like that in series three. What was it? Maggie Adarin Pocock. Lovely. Incredible scientist. Incredible woman. But other than a game on a smartphone, I don't think she's ever seen a console. It's an odd choice to make them play a VR Battlezone game.
Must have been fun beating David James at Tekken as well.
Well, I cheated on that. I got a bollocking on set for that because he was really good. And one of the secrets in the original live show was me and Sam would always be better or worse at the games to make it close. So if one team was winning lots, by having me and Sam play, we could sort of keep it interesting narratively for the sort of narrative arc of the show. And so that was one of the first ones we filmed the camp. In fact, it wasn't the first. The first one was Gorman and Josie Long was the first one we filmed. But I think they thought the cam one was the best one, which it was. So when the menu came up, I bumped up the, what do you call it? The sort of handicap thing. So right. I made his punches less effective than mine. they didn't see it on the studio floor because I knew they wouldn't, but I know I could, as a gamer, I know I could get away with that. And then this will probably be a bit closer because I thought he was going to kick my ass.
Yeah.
But, Simon spotted it backstage and mentioned it to one of the crew and I got a right bollocking for that. Like, I think in their head, they were like, well, that's cheating and you can't do that. And you go, gamers cheat. Like, absolutely call me out on it in the show and I'll put my hands up. But that's what you would do. If you thought you were going to get beat and you could get away with it, you'd change the difficulty. No one's betting on it. It's not going to be like if I drugged a horse before a big race. No one watching or in Ofcom cares that I cheated on Tekken. But yeah, they were all very worried that was somehow going to be an issue, but it wasn't.
I'd actually know this at the time, and it's only until I was watching through it recently to prep for the podcast. I actually know someone else who worked on the show, Tom Burgess, who was part of the tech team. So I do, we'd make videos with him on our board game channel.
Amazing.
And he was telling me about, like, you know, he was one of the few people that actually knew, understood how the tech works and things like that. And like, the tech side of it, the final challenge, so to speak, you know, in that first episode, it's playing Buster Move, but using Makey Makey. And you had like all the people in cosplay and stuff with Cher there.
And Cher, yeah, that's, yeah. Yeah.
But like, that, was that like the real fun bit as well? Because that was like the real sort of the mad aspect of it.
That was more, yeah, that was more like the mischief of the old, of the old forfeits, almost sort of get up and be humiliated. Like me and Sam dressed up as paddles once in horrible body tight blue suits and like squeezed sausages into being horrible. but no, they were fun. They were quite stressful sometimes, but no, they were fun. I think the only thing again with that, because Rob, who created Wi-Fi Wars, was technical manager on the show, so he had to make all those Makey Makey things. Is once they discovered Makey Makey, the non-gaming production people became a bit obsessed with it, and there's quite a lot of Makey Makey stuff in the show. Whereas actually, Rob had only ever intended us to use it once and then would do something else, but it sort of comes back again and again because they've seen it, it worked, and then go, that's how we do interactive games, we do Makey Makey. You go, no, there's like 600 other things we could do, but so once you've told somebody a thing, they go, oh, that's what it is.
And yeah.
So we sort of got lumbered with Makey Makey, but it's a very cool bit of kit, but we'd never intended it to be used as often as it was.
You mentioned that series 2 and 3 were quite stressful. You filmed them back to back and it was like a real like awful thing. But were there any like lessons learned from series 1 that you implemented into 2 and 3?
No. I wrote a very, very long document after series 1 as an attempt to illustrate by what had happened in production of series 1. Here are the things that we should look at changing. And that was almost universally ignored or dismissed. But all of the things that we've talked about today, Luke, were no doubt in that document with valid explanations of why change was necessary. But no. I told them. I did tell them.
Yeah, well, that's it. As long as you told them.
The people who were listening to this, who thought they hated me before they listened to it, learn anything from this. I hope it's that all the things you said, I said them too, and I tried so hard to make them do them, but they didn't listen. But I know, and I'm sorry.
And I suppose like the real sort of extra sad thing to end on when we're talking about
the three
series that you got is that you found out it was cancelled through Twitter.
I did. Yeah. Yeah, that wasn't very cool.
No.
By some random who'd overreached as well, I think, on on the social media. You just pay social media people, don't you, to sort of run the accounts. It's like some poor sod who just getting paid minimum wage an hour to make hilarious tweets on Twitter. No, I got caught in the middle with me going, fuck it, hang on, what? Yeah. Oh, all right. Yeah, we'd been told that it was in the balance and it was possible or probable there wouldn't be more, but we hadn't had a formal, we have made a decision that we are not making more Go 8-bit. So it was somebody tagging me on a tweet going, is that right, Steve? And me go, well, apparently. Oh, I was on holiday. I was like, oh,
okay, oh man.
Come on. Oh, all right.
You've got your Wi-Fi Wars, which you were sort of doing before, like the TV show as well, and now so kind of your focus is that. So is this really the end of Go 8-bit then, or is there? Did you want to do
we
more?
Own it.
To get live me, shows?
No. Me and Sam had to. We owned Go 8-bit in series 1, but we got paid so little. So me and Sam agreed to sell Go 8-bit, the name and the format, to the production company, so that we got paid better, which isn't great. But so it's not in our hands, and I imagine if anybody did choose to remake it at this point, given how much they didn't want me and Sam in it the first time, I doubt we'd be asked back for a reboot. So maybe Frankie Ward can do it, and Rad for one series for 3 episodes online on UK TV Play. But yeah, so no, don't any of that. I did try to make another show, a video gaming show with UK TV. But I was treated so much worse than I was a great bit. And they made such abysmal choices in the journey to pilot that that was enough for me to realise that I don't want to work with telly people anymore. So I no longer pursue TV as a medium that I create for. So, you know, we did Twitch for a while and that was fun. But now me and Rob are very, very happy doing our live show. We tour around the country, and the way it works is we make a show we like, you buy a ticket, and at the end we all fuck off. And that, no one gets to have an opinion on what it is. if you like it, you give us money, and if you don't, you don't come again. It's all very simple. It's all above board, and it has proven financially far more rewarding than working in telly, believe it or not, and spiritually, creatively, far more fulfilling. So I am very, very happy pursuing a career that doesn't involve broadcast entertainment as a source of income.
You know, like you said, the first posters for Go 8-Bit in Edinburgh were like, it's like Games Master Bit in a cupboard of drunk people. Is that what you've got on the posters for this new one? Is like, you come, you pay, and then we all fuck off.
Yeah, then you all fuck off. Well, no, because we do a family show, so that wouldn't be...
all right, you all go home.
Yeah, you all go home. Boys and girls, if any of your listeners out there do want to come to a fun, it is what Go 8-Bit would have become if it had kept being a live show, or the TV show had let us use Rob's toys. What should have happened, and we did pitch it, was that the TV show, we were going to build a version of Rob's stuff where the audience watching the TV show would play a game as part of the show. And we built that, and it exists, and we've used it for like live events online and things. But Wi-Fi Wars is, if me and Rob could have just made the show we wanted to, Wi-Fi Wars is what Go 8-Bit should have become as a live thing. So if anybody's curious what we'd have rather it had been, come to Wi-Fi Wars and see what you could have won.
So yeah. I suppose I'll give you the final word then on Go 8-Bit as we wrap this up.
Yeah. No. But if you like it, that's great. If you like it, that's great. But no.
I mean, I'll be honest with you. When we watched, I rewatched the first episode. When I watched it in 2016, I was like, oh, that's a bit of fun. But when I rewatched it, I was like, actually, it's way better than I gave it credit for. Like back in the day, actually, I thought it was, our first episode's really good.
People love it, and that's great. And I like I say, it's a really nice thing that it exists. I have a unique relationship with it that isn't what a viewer would have with it. So I have my own feelings, but I wouldn't want that to detract from the enjoyment people do get out of it, because that's a lovely thing. It's nice it made so many people happy.
Well, final thing then, plug away. What do you want to promote? What do you want to plug?
Your podcast, obviously.
Oh, thank you.
Well done for getting through it all and refusing to stop even then.
If anything, we made it longer for ourselves. Like, we really were just going to stop after series 7. And we're like, no, let's just keep going. Let's just find more things to talk about.
Start watching them again.
We did talk about that at one point, and then we're like, no, we can't do that. That's another 300 years.
If anybody wants to find out more about me, stevemcneil.com is my website. I've got a book about the history of video games, if you're not sick of my voice. It's an audio book as well. I've got a stand-up show on there you can buy from Go Faster Stripe, download it, or DVD. Come to the live show Wi-Fi. If you like video gaming comedy things, I make those, and there are various things you can acquire for money, but I won't be offended if you don't. No one pays for anything anymore, and everything's expensive now, isn't it? So keep your money, it's all right.
And on that bombshell, thank you.
Have you got a coffee or anything? Have you got like a donation? Sorry, I will let you finish. Have you got a donation thing?
We have a Patreon.
Oh, they are. Well, they are. Plug that then. Go. Don't give me any money. I'm doing all right. Give. Stick a bit of money in the Patreon for the podcast you've listened to for 300 hours and never spent a quid on.
Thank you so much for your time today.
I won't interrupt again now, Luke. I'm going to let you wrap up now. Nice clean out for the podcast.
And I
here we go. Sorry, I am shutting up now. Go.
Thank you so much for your time, and I very much apologise that this might have been a more traumatic interview than you might have intended when you agreed to do this, because I've just brought up horrible things from your past.
It's all right, I've got tablets now, I'm fine.
My thanks once again to Steve McNeil. He's on all the social medias and all that sort of stuff. Very, very grateful for him taking the time out to have a chat with me to talk about Go 8-Bit and its genesis and its history and unfortunately the demise of it. And, you know, it's a very difficult subject for him to talk about, as you can probably tell listening to that interview. So we really, really do appreciate that he took the time out of his day to have a chat with me and kind of relive some of those
Those bad times. But thank you so much to him. Please go and support him. Go check out Wi-Fi Wars as well, because it's an excellent show. But that is it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening. You all rule. If you want to find us on social media, we're at underconsolepod on Instagram and Threads at under.console. And you can send us an email to feedback@underconsultation.com. At this point here, Ash would tell me about the Discord. And you can go join our Discord and tell you about the Discord. So go and join the Discord. Link for that is in the podcast description. And then I will tell you about how you can back us on Patreon and get next week's episode, where we'll be reviewing that episode of Go 8-Bit 1 week early and ad-free over at patreon.com/underconsolepod if you back us at the £5 level. And then I'd run through all the £10 backer names, but I actually don't have those to hand and I can't access them easily. If anyone who was at UCP Live 2.0 will know that I can't do it through my phone because the Patreon app is actually a little bit bobbins. So sorry about that, £10 backers, but trust me, you're all very much loved. If you want to hear your name read out, listen to last week's episode or something, or next week's episode, because they'll be read out again then. And actually, because I don't have that, I actually don't really have a good way to end this podcast. So I'll see you next time. Take care, everyone. Good night.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.